Welcome to the third session of the 33rd Annual International Nutritional Medicine Today Conference. For those of you who were not here yesterday, I'm very sorry for you, but we had a terrific day. But this morning we have another very special session, a very unique and terrific opportunity to have these three leaders and pioneers in the area of nutrition and behavior. We're pleased to have Alex Schaus, Bernard Gesch, and Barbara Reed Stitt together in one place in one session. We're especially happy to have Alex Schaus here because the last time he visited us at this conference was not a pleasant experience for him. So we're very glad to have him back. After how many years, Alex? 15 years. I think 14 years when we were back when he was in Vancouver. So we're very pleased to have him back after a long hiatus. Alex is well known for his work in nutrition and behavior. He's the director of Natural and Medicine Products Research, Life Sciences Division, American Institute for Biosocial and Medical Research in Puyallup, Washington. Alex just was able to drive up last night, unlike Bernard Gesch, who had to fly from England. So the short and long trips will be combined here. Many of you know the work of Alex through Diet, Crime, and Delinquency and Mineral Trace Elements and Human Health. Over 125 papers, many other research assignments over his career of 25, 30 years. Alex, I'd like you to join us at the podium now. Thank you.
Good to be back. Well, it's wonderful to be back here in Vancouver, and it's wonderful to be back at this conference and to have a chance to reflect upon the progress or the lack of progress we've made, because my title is quite interesting. Rather than talk about all of the new science in the last few years, I thought it would be important to lay the foundation, especially since we're honored by Dr. Gesch and Barbara Reed to be here together, sharing the podium, same morning, which is just tremendous. But I do want to share with you my frustrations as a criminologist, as someone who is very much anchored in the area of antisocial behavior, deviancy, and crime. What I'd like to really do is give you a little bit of a flavor of how did I get into this field, what did I see, what did I observe, and basically set the stage for the other presenters today. Well, I actually was born in Germany, and my family raised me for about the first 5 years in Hamburg, Germany, after World War II. The city was approximately, 95-96% destroyed. It was just total rubble. And the most difficult thing to acquire at that time was food. A lot of people starved. And I had playmates at that time who were 2, 3, 4 years old who starved to death. And my family, fortunately, my father was able to work down in the docks as a longshoreman. So he was able to help unload food that was coming in from the United States and from Central America. So I was raised on some extraordinarily healthy food. I did not have any sugar because no one could afford it. A half a pound of sugar was the equivalent of 1 month's wage at the time. And so I grew up on bananas. My mother worked at a fish factory. So approximately, I'd say, somewhere around 12 hours a day processing fish into cans. So I had a lot of fish oil to start life off with. And I was never sick. I had no vaccinations. And I think the good nutrition had a great deal to do with just getting me off on a proper footing. However, when I came to the United States, which ironically was on Halloween in 1953, I saw some pretty strange things walking around for the first time in New York City and Manhattan. I saw children with painted faces, chalk in powdered chalk in socks who were hitting every adult they could find. And I looked up at my mom and dad. I said, I got to go home. These kids are crazy here. So I was not really looking forward to spending more time in the United States. And in fact, I even refused to speak English for 2.5 years, convinced that my parents were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that certainly we were going back to Germany, where at least I watched children who were far more disciplined. Little did I know that one day a psychologist would give me an IQ test because I was in a class for retarded children because I refused to speak English, even though we spoke 6 languages at home, and told my parents that I was bright enough to be in a regular class, and why was I not speaking English? That's the first time my parents found out I wasn't speaking English in the classroom. So needless to say, I got in a lot of trouble when I got home, and I learned English real quick because my parents were pretty strong disciplinarians. So anyway, I'm going to go through a little geography lesson throughout this lecture, and this is, of course, the eastern part of the United States, pretty much west of the Mississippi River. And what we're basically looking at is where I started my sojourn. There's New York State, and eventually we get to New York City, and there's 5 boroughs, and then we get to Manhattan. And I lived, and actually in an area, let's see if this works. Ooh, okay, there we go. I lived in this area called the Upper West Side. Now, the Upper West Side at this time, in fact, that star where it says Burlington Interactive is a company that's actually in the building that I grew up in. It's a slum. We paid $84 a month rent for a 3-bedroom apartment, which we shared with quite a few rats and mice and lots of cockroaches. We could count them by the thousands. It was just a hideous place. It was one of the worst ghettos in the city. And that's 89th Street between Amsterdam and Columbus Avenue. And that also had the largest gang in New York City, the Comanches, with 5,000 members. And they were very well known for their viciousness. And so having to grow up as a child in the midst of one of the most vicious gangs, surrounded by a lot of drug abuse, prostitution, robberies, I watched some awful things happening almost every few weeks that are hard to describe. I watched one man coming home very drunk. He had 2 daughters. He was screaming at them. Then he sealed their door somehow and set their room on fire, and they burned to death. And that was just a couple of apartments away from where I was staying. And this was pretty typical in the neighborhood I was in. Nobody looked at this. There was no stories in the newspapers there would be today. People really didn't care about what was going on in these sections of the city. And so there's a book that was written by Joseph P. Lyford, who is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And it's called The Airtight Cage, A Study of New York's West Side. And he wrote in there that when the slum is used as a concentration camp for the criminal and disabled, the virulence of the diseases endemic in slum life is intensified. What he's really saying is, if you think it's bad where you live, you should try to live in one of these environments. And he, along with the New York Times and several other New York newspapers, documented that in that neighborhood I lived, there had not been a single male that had managed to get to college since World War II. So it was a really bad place to live. The schools were not the best, and there was a lot of corruption there in law enforcement as well. There's a foundation in Texas that set up a program for the homeless and for people in need of food and shelter. And I found this very interesting, their comment, after reading The Airtight Cage, because it actually motivated he and his wife to set up this multi-million-dollar foundation immediately after finishing this book. And he said, "Wantlessness. I really never understood the term until I read the book, The Airtight Cage. It was really a story of the ghetto's community struggle to survive. He depicted through personal observation what was occurring in this New York ghetto. He saw firsthand the struggle of those imprisoned in the ghetto to survive. Yes, by any means possible. Their ways were not very pretty. One thing for certain, they had more concern about bread than they did about education. So it was a real struggle to survive. So in essence, I really moved from one area of the world where food was a scarcity to another area of the world where food also remained a scarcity." Well, This is a rather unpleasant memory for me as well, because just a few blocks from Needle Park, which is about 73rd to 75th Street, cross-section by Amsterdam Avenue and Broadway, was known as Needle Park. This was a place back when I went to junior high school 44, William J. O'Shea, that was littered with hypodermic needles. And we had about, in my junior high school, it was estimated, again documented by journalists in New York City, that approximately half of my classmates were heroin addicts. Half of my third grade dropped out of school, and I made some attempts later on when I was at the University of New Mexico to find out what happened to many of my third grade colleagues, and 80% of them had died or were in state institutions such as Sing Sing. Needle Park was particularly bad because there were, sometimes this breaks me up, so I'm going to go kind of easy on this. There were about 300 or 400 of my colleagues, both males and females, 12 to 14 years old, who prostituted. Basically around a block away from our junior high school was the American Museum of Natural History, and there was like a little park around that, and this is where they would earn their money doing what they had to do to earn enough money to support their drug habit, and yet I would be in the same classes with them, and everybody knew what everybody was doing. So this was a pretty tough neighborhood to go into. And so we watched a lot of that, and it was a very common thing for me to go up and down the staircase at the school and have to walk around hypodermic needles and apologize for bothering somebody while they were shooting up before they went to class. So Needle Park has actually been depicted one of Al Pacino's earliest movies. And this is still available if you ever want to get kind of a flavor for what life was like. There was actually shot at Needle Park in New York. And this particular park was made quite famous by this this film about Manhattan's Upper Side. Now, I got really interested in the whole field of nutrition, not only because food was a very important part of my life from the very beginning, and also to my family, but I began to spend more and more time in a public library on 83rd Street and Amsterdam. And just to get there was literally to risk one's life, because being on 89th Street, just a few blocks away, and being on the street which was known to be the headquarters of the Comanches meant that anyone who lived there was a member. And so if you traveled more than two blocks from your neighborhood, you were game to be attacked by other gangs. And I had more than my share of stab wounds and fights just to survive. And so it was a real struggle to even make it to the public library just six blocks away. But this is where I started finding very interesting books. And I've kept some of these books, and I was able to acquire them from a used bookstore in Lower Manhattan, and they're still part of my library of about 12,000, 13,000 books. And this one is called 100,000 Guinea Pigs. It was originally written in 1933. And it described and really asked the question, are we all not guinea pigs? Is there not some massive experiment going on in terms of the foods of commerce that will destroy our health and destroy our nation? And there were other books as well that also affected my life. And the Furnaces book, Furnace and Furnace, The Story of Man and His Food, again, my interest in nutrition and diet and its influence on health and behavior was also influenced by these authors. And this book was written in 1935. The McCarrison, Sir Robert McCarrison, wrote a brilliant work, which was published in London and also found its way to my library somehow. And this book had a particularly strong effect on me because he wrote a really an eloquent documentation back in 1936 of the pathway that we as a society, as supposedly an intelligent society, were taking ourselves through processing of food and the end result in terms of disease and degeneration. Well, heroin addiction, of course, was of great interest to me because of the fact that my classmates in elementary school, particularly in middle school, and then even in high school, the high school I went to had about 5,000 students. I'd say it was about 90% Hispanic and Black, and so clearly I was in the minority there, and I constantly saw a lot of drug use. and other forms of antisocial and aberrant behavior. When I went, I tried to get as far away from New York City as possible. I got a very nice scholarship to attend any university in the country. I walked away from going to Brown University because I wasn't very attracted to Ivy League schools and their attitude, so I wanted something that was multicultural, and I found New Mexico to be the ideal place for me to move to. It was also very far from New York, and I needed a respite from that environment. But my parents still lived on the west side of Manhattan, so of course I would come home during the summers, and during Christmas time, and occasionally at other holidays. I also had been a cab driver for New York. I was a hack, as they say. So I spent a couple of years driving a taxi cab as a way of earning a living, and I was one of the very few white taxi cab drivers that would actually drive around Harlem. And so each time I drove around Harlem, which most of you know is a predominantly black community, most of the passengers, of course, were black, and they used to give me very large tips because they call that funeral money. They said, what's a white boy doing in a black neighborhood like this? So here's your funeral money. So I would get very large tips, and I'd come back to the garage loaded down with money, and of course all that went toward my education. So I had a lot of fun, but I learned a lot from people, because in those taxi cabs there were anywhere from about 60 to 80 different passengers each day that I drove. And I learned a lot from them. It was very, very interesting, the stories that they shared, and people from all over the world. And then in the summer of 1968, I was back in New York City driving a taxi cab and taking some classes at the City University of New York. And I found that there was an opportunity in a class taught by Dr. Herskowitz in sociology on juvenile delinquency to do an internship. And because addiction was an area that I was always interested in, what makes people want to stick needles in their arm and get high all the time, she said, well, there's an addiction treatment center in Harlem, and I can get you placed there. And I said, let's do it. And I went in there, and unfortunately what I saw, you know, it just really shocked me, because this was a place where addicts would come off the street and go through what's called cold turkey. And this is these withdrawals they would experience, where they would have terrible stomach pains, they would vomit a lot, they couldn't sleep, they were constantly sweating, terrible backaches, their skin would break out, and this experience would continue for about 10 to 14 days. And I said, there's got to be a better way, and I was aware that there had been some suggestions that vitamin C occupied opioid receptor sites. And so I wondered if we use massive amounts of vitamin C, whether we could not help them reduce or possibly eliminate those cold turkey symptoms. And by gosh, it worked. You're going to think this is kind of crazy, and probably what I know today I would not have done yesterday. And possibly being naive really helped the situation out. But I developed a protocol where I would go as high as 250 grams, that's a quarter of a pound, of vitamin C a day orally. And what was interesting is, and by the way, that takes about 10 days to get up to that level, but I would start at about 10 grams, work my way to 20 grams, 60 grams, 100 grams, 150 grams, right up to 200, 250 grams rather quickly. And what the addicts were saying is that, give me more, because the more I gave them, the less symptoms they had. And so through that experience and working with scores and scores of addicts, I eventually sort of figured out exactly how much to use on day one through day five, so that once they were experiencing their withdrawal symptoms, as they no longer were taking heroin, they would have absolutely no symptoms, no side effects, nothing during withdrawal. It was amazing to watch. And then when the blood test came back, because they were also doing some blood studies over by Columbia University, they found that their hepatitis A was just disappearing. So there was the support for the concept of it being an antiviral agent. So this was very, very fascinating. And I continued to do this throughout the summer and did fairly well in the class. Herskowitz was pretty impressed by the work that I did. But the City of New York medical director was not, and he accused me of practicing medicine without a license. So this is the first time in my life that I suddenly realized, gee, there's politics here in this whole scheme of things. And I'm a pretty assertive guy, and I don't like to be pushed around. Remember the neighborhood I lived in, and I'm white, and I did survive, and I'm alive today for a reason. So I looked him straight in the eye after meeting with him downtown, and I said, you know what, I'd really encourage you to file charges against me for practicing medicine without a license, because I'd like to take this whole thing public. And he looked at me like, you know, he thought I was just going to cower down and stop. I said, I'm going right back there tonight, and I'm going to continue doing exactly what I'm doing. And if you want to have me arrested, by God, do it, because I'll be the first to pick it in front of the Herald Tribune and the New York Times and any other newspaper I can and bring a story to the public. So do it. And, of course, he didn't. But eventually I had to go back to the University of New Mexico in September to continue my studies. But I continue to help heroin addicts when I got to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and that's going to be a very interesting story. Because 10 years later, after helping countless addicts in the barrios of Albuquerque, Bernalillo County, New Mexico, which had the second highest per capita use of heroin in the United States, I, about 10 years later, was the director of the Graduate Institute for Biosocial Research at City University in Seattle. City University today has the largest MBA program in the United States. Fortunately, my boss, the dean, was Dr. Clifford Simonson, who was a noted criminologist. He had, at that time, 6 textbooks being used by 800 universities and colleges in the United States in criminology. And it was Clifford who persuaded me to get out of government service, and you'll learn a little bit about what I did in my government work for some 9 years, to actually sort of park myself in an academic environment. And I was asked in 1978 to speak at a medical conference in Seattle to talk a little bit about my work on nutrition and behavior. And I happened to mention how I had used vitamin C starting 1968 to treat heroin addicts. And in the audience was Dr. Janice Keller Phelps, who is a noted expert in alcohol and addiction treatment. She was formerly with the National Institute for Drug Abuse and with the Department of Juvenile Rehabilitation for the state of Maryland as their state medical director. And she was really incensed that I was working with heroin addicts in her own county, King County, which is Seattle is part of King County. And she was really, really upset. And she said she was going to expose this fraud, this nonsense, this use of supplements as a way of treating heroin addicts. And I treated her very similar to the way I treated the medical doctor in New York City. And I said, go ahead, you know, charge me, do whatever you've got to do. Because I've always believed that in the end, the truth always wins. It may not occur in our lifetime, but it will occur eventually. And Janice, however, was a very intelligent woman who decided that rather than just accuse me, which would have been very easy of practicing medicine without a license in the state of Washington, she would actually try it and prove to herself and to her colleagues and to others and to me in particular that this was a worthless treatment modality. So that summer, she worked with 32 hardcore heroin addicts who were over 30 years old and who had spent a minimum of 15 years going through various federal, state, and private treatment programs. She calls me up the first week of August and she says, Alex, this is like a cure to cancer. This is the most incredible thing I've ever seen. It's exactly as you described at the conference. I've got to get people here from the National Institute of Drug Abuse. So she called them up, and she knew the deputy director, and they arranged immediately for 3 of their top government officials from NIDA to come to Seattle, Washington. They spent 1 week in the city, and at the exit meeting, not only with her, but also with my university, so they met with the president, the executive vice president, the dean of the graduate school, again, Dr. Simonson, myself, and a few others, describing how remarkable it was what they had learned from watching how this works, and also interviewing not only people in programs, but accidentally during, I think it was a Thursday, they ran into people in the street that had heard that NIDA was there, and these addicts found these NIDA officials to tell them that the beauty of this treatment is that it could be done without necessarily checking into a rehabilitation facility. In other words, you could learn this protocol, share it with another addict who might say, look, I'm using way too much heroin, I'm prostituting too much, I'm stealing too much to support my habit, I need to do something. And they would say, hey, you know, I just was in this program, they're using vitamin C, here's how it's done, and it would work. And so they were just like, wow, we're going back to Washington, D.C., and we're going to get this program incorporated nationwide. 8 months went by, 8 months. And finally, the executive vice president, Dr. Civitello, said to Dr. Simonson, Cliff, why don't you give him a call and find out whatever happened to them? You know, it's been months since their visit here, and we've never heard a thing. So Cliff called, and we were on a speakerphone, and this guy says to us that they calculated that over 80% of the rehabilitation worker in the addiction fields in the United States would be unemployed if this program was incorporated. And if I hadn't heard it, I wouldn't have believed it. If there hadn't been witnesses listening to this, I mean, we literally, our jaws dropped, we looked at each other in total disbelief. And later we learned that one of the people that was on that field visit to Seattle, sister worked in New Orleans, Louisiana, as the director of one of the largest heroin addiction treatment facilities in the United States. And she calculated that virtually all of her staff would have to be laid off if this protocol was handed over to addicts. So NIDA never took an official position, never wrote up this report, and this was a point in life where I got kind of mad. You know, you get a little angry. It's sort of like a moment where you have to put on a uniform and fight for your country because it's under attack. And I said, this is truly ridiculous. And this also had a lot to do with my motivation to really, you know, travel around the world, travel around to as many conferences and programs and universities and colleges and just talk about all of the things related to nutrition and behavior that would help people out. In 1977, Alfred Libby and Irwin Stone attempted to popularize this use of vitamin C for the detoxification of narcotic addicts. They based their approach on the theory that addicts were malnourished, deficient in protein, and deficient in vitamin C. Hence, they had what they referred to as the hyperascorbemia kwashiorkor syndrome. And Libby and Stone confirmed that 25 to 85 grams of vitamin C per day resulted in loss of craving for the drug. Similar results were reported by Dr. Archie Kalikonoris and Dr. Glenn Dittman in Australia, whom I eventually met in Sydney in 1980. Their work, Every Second Child, attests to the life-saving power of vitamin C. Now, I had a wonderful meeting with Dr. Irwin Stone in the late 1970s. He, by the way, patented the use of vitamin C as an antioxidant in 1935. But the most extraordinary story was when I arrived to give a lecture at the University of Sydney Law School in 1980. And I was on a tour, and I was just doing some research. I was looking for what was causing what looked like Parkinson's disease in Guam. And I had discovered very high intakes of aluminum in Guam and was suggesting at that time that high levels of aluminum were related to Guamanian Parkinsonism. And on my way to Sydney, I started, you know, feeling a little sick. And by the time I arrived in Sydney, and those were the days when jets were a little bit slower than today, I was exhausted, and it was about noon, and I had a 105.2 temperature at the time, and it was about 106 at 2 o'clock, and I was supposed to lecture at 6 o'clock, and they already had 650 seats sold for this lecture. So they called Archie Kalikonoris up. Archie came over about an hour later. He wanted to hear me, so he came from north of New South Wales, the section where he works with Aboriginals, and arrived and just put IV drip, vitamin C, and in 3 hours my temperature was down to 100.5. And at 7 o'clock I gave a lecture, and I didn't stop lecturing from 7 p.m. till 11:15 p.m. No one left the audience, and we just, you know, it's like all this data just came out of me. It was an amazing experience. I mean, a man just... You know, so if you ever take an exam, maybe the thing to do the next time you have a law test or, you know, a bar exam or some major, you know, dissertation defense or whatever, maybe IV vitamin C drips might be the answer. I don't know. That's one observation, but certainly a testament to its power. By the way, I do want to mention also Archie wrote a brilliant book, Every Second Child, which it's a real emotionally wrenching work. Archie shared it with me personally, and I encouraged him, and I said, you know, Archie, you've got to write a book about this. You've got to get a documentary done, and they've done a film on it. They wrote a book about it. It could be an Academy Award winner, because what it is, it's the tale of a man who was out in the outback practicing conventional medicine, and we watched the Australian Public Health Service out of Canberra go around inoculating with vaccinations children who were Aboriginals. And half those children would die within a week after these vaccinations. Without getting into the whole elaborate story of how he figured this out, he did one day decide to start giving children shots of vitamin C, 1 gram in the butt, and just see what would happen. And none of those children, he discovered, died. So he went back to Canberra and told them that by giving an injection of vitamin C, we could save these children's lives. Nobody cared about it, absolutely no one. And these children just kept dying all over the country as the public health service would go from town to town, and parents would, you know, hide their children away from these public health officials because they knew there was a 50% mortality rate. I mean, the news spreads very easily. And so finally what he decided to do to prove that this actually worked, when they sent Dr. Glenn Detman to investigate him and to possibly remove his medical license because he was practicing unconventional medicine, Glenn Detman watched Archie Colokonoris give vitamin C or placebo, a saline solution, to monozygotic twins, Aboriginal twins. And then they would show up a week later, give him the vaccination, and one of the really sad moments of his life, he would watch a sibling literally die in the same crib, and there's the other sibling who got the vitamin C bouncing in the crib, as healthy and alive as can be. And despite having done this 5 times and demonstrating to Dr. Glenn Detman the power of vitamin C, they did take his medical license. Dr. Archie Colokonoris, a very bitter man at that point, decided to become an opal miner. And he went down to Coba Pedy, about 100 miles north of Melbourne, a desolate, dry, awful place to live, and became a world-renowned expert on opals. In fact, he has a brilliant work, beautifully illustrated work, which is a classic in its field on opals. And eventually, the Australian government saw the insanity of what they had done to Aboriginals and to people like him. And he eventually got his license back and went back into practice. So I was very fortunate in meeting Archie back in 1980 to learn firsthand what his life experience had been. But this is truly, to me, an Academy Award-winning movie that would really tell the story about nutrition in a very, very powerful and effective way. There was another book written by Piri Thomas called Down These Mean Streets, which is a true story of the deadly consolidation of drugs, street fighting, and robbery. And this is in Harlem, Spanish Harlem, because that's the kids I went to high school with. Well, as I said, I needed to get out of New York City. I went as far away as I could. I didn't want to go to Los Angeles because I heard there were a lot more New Yorkers there, too. So I said, they're not going to get me again. So I got to Albuquerque, which is a very pleasant community, about 180,000 people at the time, and went to the University of New Mexico. And part of what attracted me is studying geology and mineralogy. I mentioned to you that at my junior high school, we were a block from the American Museum of Natural History, and at the age of 8, I took a great interest, I don't know, just a fascination with minerals. That one of the great, they had the greatest mineral collection in the world at the museum at the time. And I used to leave my thumbprints and my fingerprints and my nose prints on the glass there, and the curator one day caught me after the guard, you know, pointed me out to him, came up to me, says, "I guess you really like minerals." I said, "Really? These are beautiful." And he started pulling them out of the drawer and just giving me these minerals, you know, to take home. Little did I realize how valuable they were later in life. But New Mexico seemed like a wonderful place to study geology, and it was. And so I went there with the intention of studying geology, but the life that I grew up in suggested maybe sociology was the course that I should take, and that was eventually the bachelor's degree that I earned. I want to point out this is a beautiful mineral in the center there, colinarite. It's rarely found anywhere in the world, and New Mexico is one of the very few blue linarites found in nature. And this is the reason why, over the years, I continue to study minerals, trace elements, and human health. This is my most recent book, and here's my advertising for the day. There's 20 copies in the back of the room. Well, the University of New Mexico was a fabulous place to go to school. Terrific faculty, excellent education. I did my bachelor's and master's degree and actually started my doctorate work there. My span was from 1966 through about 1974. While I was at the university in my senior year, I was offered an internship working in the juvenile probation and parole department of the Second Judicial District of New Mexico. The internship was interesting. I got a chance to handle some minor traffic cases, some juveniles that got arrested for driving recklessly or endangering others and things of that nature. Learned a little bit about psychometric testing, which actually became a focus of my graduate studies for my master's degree. I drove around with police officers and sheriffs to kind of get a sense of, you know, what community crime problems were like. And I attended a lot of court hearings and put in enough hours to get my credits for my class. My first week, as soon as I graduated a little quick, 3.5 years, I had my bachelor's degree, I was offered full-time employment. And this was a really tough decision because I had a job offer working for PepsiCo International in their junior executive management program for a starting salary of something like $60,000, which I thought, well, that's pretty good. And I had actually worked at Pepsi headquarters for Burns Detective Agency as a guard. So that's on Park Avenue 59th Street in New York one summer. So I knew the chairman of the board, he and I started talking, he liked to run, and I was a track runner, and so we would run around Central Park together, and I could speak German. His wife was a German duchess, and so we got along really well, and he says, you know, as soon as you graduate, I've got a great job for you, and we'll start you off in Phoenix and get you kind of acquainted with things on a regional, and then a few years you come back to New York and you work, and we'll get you a good job here. So I had sort of my life all worked out to join a Fortune 500 company. And here I had this internship in the probation department, I loved the work. I absolutely loved the work. I loved the opportunity to help people and to try to, in some small way, influence their lives. So I decided to take a job for $4,900 a year. My parents looked at me like, and you went to college, why? But they were very supportive. I began to explain to them what I do and why I enjoy this type of work. But there was a lot of things I learned very, very quickly. The first thing was that it had the highest serious Part 1 crime rate in the United States, according to the FBI. So it had more serious crimes per capita than any city, community in the United States. Fresno, California was second on that list, and if they doubled their crime rate, they would still not have as much crime as Albuquerque, Bernalillo County. Second thing is it had the second highest heroin addiction rate in the United States, second only to New York City. So there was that problem again. And to give you an idea how dangerous it was, the first night I went out in a patrol car, and I'd just been employed now. I was a deputy sheriff, a parole officer, probation officer for the state. I went out with a police officer. His name was Sandy. Sandy and I, we got along very well that evening. The next night, he pulled over a car that there was a radio call that somebody had just committed an armed robbery. He pulled this man into an alley and did not call a backup and did not realize they had a sawed-off shotgun in the driver's seat. And as he approached the car and stuck his head in there, they shot his head right off. And so I went to his funeral a few days later. So it kind of woke me up to the reality of how dangerous, you know, a community I was actually in, living at the university, one doesn't realize this, but it was very serious. And then there was a child who changed my life. And this was a 14-year-old boy who had 25 felonies already. I started at the age of 9, frequently incarcerated, but never to a state institution. I was always reluctant in sending any child to a state institution because I had heard repeatedly from my friends in the streets of New York what an institution was like. An institution was a place where you got raped, where you got assault, where your dignity was stolen from you. This boy, however, had committed so many crimes and was so out of control that was the first child of many that I would ever suggest to the court should be incarcerated in a state institution. Because he was 14-year-old and the nature of the crimes, he could also possibly have been adjudicated as an adult and sent to the state penitentiary in Santa Fe. I went to court with a recommendation to put him in institution because I looked at everything I could and I could not figure out what I could do for this boy. Parents were exasperated. They were good parents. They just couldn't figure out what to do. And he got an attorney because anytime we're recommending institutionalization by law, we had to provide a legal counsel. And the attorney told Judge Edwin Swope that he was of the opinion that Alex Schaus had not done a very good job and that there should be some other reason because people don't commit crimes like this without a reason, and that maybe there is something physically wrong with him. Well, okay. So the judge said, Alex, take him to find a pediatrician and have him evaluated and come back to court next week. So he deferred the case for 1 week. And it was very hard to find a pediatrician who wanted to see a juvenile in handcuffs and leg irons. So we found one. We found one at Loveless Hospital. And with this pediatrician was a visiting geneticist from Vienna, Austria, a pediatric geneticist, who, upon this boy taking his clothes off for physical examination, immediately identified Klinefelter syndrome. And they did a blood test, and they confirmed it. And we had to delay the case another week to get the blood results back. And then we went back to court. And this geneticist came to court and told Judge Swope that, one, she was impressed that the juvenile court in Albuquerque was wise enough to send children for physical examinations of this nature. Little did she know this was the first case in the history of this department that anybody ever cared about the child's physical condition. And that this child could be treated because what he had was an abnormality of chromosomes. And she then explained that he had virtually no penis, his testes had not dropped out of the sac, he had breasts developing as a female at the age of 14, and that as a way for compensating for the embarrassment of looking like a female and having feminine physical traits, he would act out constantly in an aggressive machismo way in that New Mexico culture as a way of getting along with his peers. And that also explained to me for the first time why he had a history for 4 years of never going to a physical education class, because he was so afraid of being in the locker room and having boys see what his physical appearance looked like. And that really hit me because I said, oh my God, I was just about to put a boy in an institution who certainly would have been raped repeatedly. And I looked at myself in a mirror and I said, my God, Alex, what do you really know about how to help these children? You don't. I mean, whatever these universities prepared you for, all this good education you got in your classes, they're useless. You know, they didn't help me here. I mean, this was a total accident that I ran into an Austrian geneticist who would help us to determine what's really going on with this child. I'll tell you a lovely story about what happened to this boy, and it's talk about fate. In the 1990s, I was flying to a national conference in Texas, and I decided to go to Albuquerque because they told me that they never gave me my letter jacket from being on the track and cross-country team at the university. So I went there, and the athletic department director handed me the leather jacket and apologized. But I graduated half a year early, so that, I mean, that was the reason why. It was no embarrassment on his part. And so I went to Dallas, Texas, and on this airplane, a gentleman comes up to me in a United States Air Force uniform, and he says, are you Mr. Schaus? And I said, yes, I am. Didn't recognize him. He says his name. He says, do you know who I am? And I didn't recall. And he said, I'm the boy that you almost sent in an institution that you took to the hospital, and you saved my life. And he told me how he eventually went to an institution to have this treated, basically through some endocrine treatments. And up in Colorado, he went then to the University of New Mexico on a full scholarship, and joined the United States Air Force, was becoming a pilot. He knew they could never have children because of his condition, but he just stood there and he says, I just want to thank you. And a man, just tears just rolled down my face. You know, it's just amazing. So we can make a difference in people's lives. And while I was at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine, this was particularly my graduate school, as I continued to learn more and more about crime, the relationship between nutrition, crime, and other physical disorders that influence deviant behavior, I came across all these amazing papers that are just buried in research libraries everywhere. Here's one in 1936. Where it states, 15 years ago, it would have been preposterous to assume that there could be any relationship between sugar metabolism and crime. That's 1936, and we're still fighting that battle today. Well, after Albuquerque and New York and the rubble of Hamburg, Germany, I decided I really got to get away from all of this. And so there was an offer as a state assistant administrator for the Department of Social Services in the state of South Dakota, and I said, I'm going, you know, because not only did I have to deal with a high crime rate, but if you look at the areas that say northwest, north central, and central, all that area, and a little part of the southwest, that was my jurisdiction. So I also saw what was happening to the native population with the foods of commerce. It was devastating. It was worse when I went to Gallup, which was part of my jurisdiction in the 2nd Judicial District, and I saw as many as 100,000 Native Americans drunk on a Friday and a Saturday night and thousands getting arrested, and also seeing the level of corruption that white people were involved with and taking advantage of the Native population. It was disgraceful. And it was just the point at which I said, I've got to get out of here. And I had my master's degree. And I said, you know, enough of this, because we were working with a lot of criminals like this. And eventually out of the department, again, $4,900. We had the highest caseload in the United States. We had 13,100 criminals to deal with per year. There were 8 officers to prepare all those reports. It was awful. And by the time I finished 4 years later, leaving the department, becoming a criminal justice planner with the federal government, my salary was still at $5,700. And I'll tell you, that Pepsi International job offer looked pretty attractive when you try to figure out how you pay your rent, food, own a car, and things of that nature, and $5,700. There were other reports, and this is just a quick history. In 1974, DeSaro in Morristown, New Jersey, did a study on adult incarcerated offenders. And they started to show that in an eight-week period using diet and dietary supplements, you could cause a very significant improvement in their behavior and their rates of antisocial behavior, and even in terms of self-perception. This was the program that they used. I put this into the work Orthomolecular Treatment of Criminal Offenders, which you might recall I wrote in 1978, and it describes the actual program that they used. So this finally led me to move to South Dakota. This is a nice road map of the state. And in the center of it is Pier, which is the state capital, the only capital in the United States that does not have an interstate going through it. And this was another major turning point in my life, and this is where I think my convictions became very strong. And this was one day when I had to visit all of these facilities around the state. I was hiring a lot of youth service program officials for the state, and our goal was to deinstitutionalize the state's correctional system and become the first state in the United States that actually would require no prisons for offenders. And we were almost there doing this, and the people that helped us were foster parents and group homes and residential treatment facilities that were non-incarcerative in nature. We treated the parents as we treated the children, and I think this was an important part of the program. But in Huron, South Dakota, which is east, about 100 miles from Pierce, South Dakota, I saw something very remarkable. I saw house parents that used nutrition as a way of changing these children's behavior. It was so impressive that when we went back to look at how much money we were saving on every child going to this facility compared to any other facility in the state, I knew that we were really onto something. This was a story that had to be told nationwide. And at the same time, Barbara Reed, who is I'm very delighted is here today, and I've missed not seeing her and talking to her for many, many years. Barbara was also experiencing the same thing in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, not far from Cleveland, Ohio. And because you might recall that George McGovern was the senator from South Dakota, the state I was working in at the time, Barbara had the opportunity to testify before the United States Senate Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs on her experience in treating 318 offenders with diet and supplements. And she stated, of these 252 required attention as to their diet and vitamin needs. And then she pointed out that we have had not one single person back in court for trouble who has maintained and stayed on the nutritional diet. In concluding her remarks, she stated, quote, never before has the court had such a tool for working with the many ill people who find themselves in court. So Barbara also had an influence on me, because it wasn't too much later that I got a call from the chief juvenile judge in Denver, Colorado, who said, Alex, there's a chief probation officer's job opened up in Pierce County, Washington. I would encourage you to apply for it. And I said, well, gee, I'm just, 28 years old. The chief is usually 40, 45, 50 years old. And he said, no, I think you'd have a good chance. You've gotten a lot of training from the Department of Justice. You've traveled around the country. A lot of people know you. And you might have it. So anyway, I applied, thinking I would not have a chance at all. So did 60 other people who I felt were far better qualified than myself. And I was asked I was one of the finalists, so they flew me into Tacoma, Washington. I was interviewed by 27 judges and the court administrator, and a month later they said, you got the job. And I go, oh my God, 28 years old, I'm a chief probation officer, I can retire when I'm 42, that type of thing. So what I didn't know is very corrupt county. And within a year, to make a story I can't really tell you too much about, we had the county sheriff and 24 other officials in federal penitentiary for things like arson, attempted murder, and it's just an incredible mess that I found myself working in. But anyway, it cleaned up the county. Today it's a phenomenal place. It has 7 museums, an entirely different form of government. Corruption is gone, and it's a great place to live. If you're, again, geography lessons for those of you from other parts of the country or the world and are not familiar with it, this is Washington State divided into counties, and you can see the one county, that's Pierce County. And what's interesting about Pierce County, on one end is it's got ocean water, and on the other end, going east, is Mount Rainier, and that's 14,410 feet tall, has over 30 glaciers. And it's always active. It's supposed to explode here sometime soon, and we hope it doesn't occur. That's where we worked, in the state building there. Now that I was in that particular situation, oh, by the way, let me see if I can go back here for a moment. If I could just go back, just in case I still included that map. Do you know what's interesting about this map? I just took this off the internet. You can see Friday, April 30th at 4 p.m. Do you see that there's a little seismic activity occurring around Mount Rainier right now? This is why it's good to be in Vancouver, British Columbia, right now. Okay, I just want you to all relax. We're too far away from Mount Rainier for us to worry for right now. Okay, thank you. I just needed to have that reassurance. Dr. Linus Pauling was also a very influential person in my life. Incredible man. I mean, if you just look at him and he just emanates peace. What a brilliant man. And I miss him. And I think all of us who had a chance to know him miss him as well. A unique individual, as we say, a mensch of the greatest proportions. And he stated that orthomolecular medicine is the achievement and preservation of good mental health by provision of the optimum molecular environment for the mind, especially the optimum concentration of substances normally present in the human body. Now, that's what I learned from him when I was chief probation officer, and I decided, you know what, I'm going to put this to the scientific test. I think that's what we really need to do. So what I next decided to do, starting in 1977, was to start some quasi-experimental studies on criminal offenders and delinquents beginning in Washington State. And the first was the Pierce County Adult Probation Department, because guess what? I was the boss. So I could decide that we were going to do this study, which we later published in the Orthomolecular Journal. And then we did a second study. This was a really difficult one in both King and Pierce County. That's the Seattle-Tacoma area. I had to find 36 co-investigators to help me collect data on interviews that we would do with tape recordings and transcripts that we had to do of those recordings to determine this very interesting question. If I took emotionally disturbed children or behaviorally disordered children or learning disabled children who, however, had no criminal record, no history of delinquency, and compared them against a group that were delinquent, would we see a difference? And what would it be? Would there be anything that was nutritional in nature? And I thought, okay, it's probably sugar, it's probably food additives, because the Feingold diet was being popularized at the time, food allergies, things of that nature. And we found a very surprising finding. First, with the adult population, we found that if we combined information about using diet and nutrition and dietary supplements with conventional counseling techniques, we could have a dramatic reduction in recidivism rate, repeat arrest rates. And it was very impressive. And so this was the first quasi-experimental evidence that had been produced along rather more scientific lines documenting this improvement. The second one was the study in Pierce and King County with juveniles. This I co-authored with Clifford Simonson, again, the dean at the City University, the famous criminologist. And the trouble was that after doing this analysis on the data, we came up with something rather incredible. And we brought in someone else that many of you have also heard from and know, Jeffrey Bland, who at the time was a chemist, assistant professor at the University of Puget Sound in the Department of Chemistry. And this was to try to figure out why did we come up with the results we did. Well, I went down, oh, and one other thing in that same issue, maybe I should do this first. I was also looking at the effects of color on the suppression of human aggression. And this was because at City University, I had an opportunity to work with Dr. John Ott, who many of you know, and we were able to obtain a $50,000 grant from the Lesley Foundation in Chicago, and we started doing studies on the effects of color and lighting on aggressive behavior. And this was really interesting because we identified something which I call Baker-Miller pink, which had this dramatic effect within seconds, faster than an injectable tranquilizer, making people calm. And I had a chance to use it at the U.S. Naval Correctional Facility in Seattle, and where they used to have one serious altercation a day, usually attacks against staff or between inmates. After we introduced this pink room, kind of a timeout room at the institution, there were zero incidences recorded of any aggressive behavior for a six-month period. And this went back to the Defense Department in Washington, D.C. And eventually, this led to a lot of interest by other correctional institutions around the country. And the next one we did was in San Jose, Santa Clara County, California, where they had the exact same results. They suddenly dropped the incidence of aggressive violent behavior to zero. San Bernardino County did the same thing. Dr. Buccamini there, a psychologist, reported back on his results. And pretty soon we went, whoa, we've really got something here that we can use in correctional institutions to reduce the level of violence, both to staff and to inmates. And so it started to become somewhat popularized, and then National Public Radio and then PBS took an interest in it, and they sent a film crew to San Jose, invited me down there, and they demonstrated exactly how fast this worked. And they took a lieutenant on the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Department, and this man was using these barbells of about 110 pounds and just lifting them like they were nothing. Huge 25-inch biceps, and then they showed him the pink color, and he could not move these biceps. He just couldn't believe it. No matter how much he tried, he just couldn't move them. He lost all his strength. And he said, wow, this is really incredible. Well, that taping turned out to be of some value to a show called That's Incredible, which was, I believe, the most popular television show in the nation at the time. And they showed it one evening, this 20-minute program about this invention, this discovery of this Baker-Miller pink. And from that point on, my phones went absolutely bonkers, and the post office would have hundreds, sometimes more than hundreds, of letters requesting swatches and copies of all this. But what eventually happened is you get these wonderful things like, no wonder the Pink Panther is a pussycat, stories. And then look at this, what happened in professional sports. They banned Baker Miller Pink. This was a fighter who was, according to all the odds makers, guaranteed to lose this battle. And he comes out, his name was Thomas, in pink shorts. Okay? Now, you know, when you box, you don't come out in pink shorts, okay? It's just not the right thing to do. And so he shows up, of course, just like you. You know, the audience is, you know, the crowd's laughing. Okay, he's got his pink shorts. He had a pink gown on, so he comes out there. He shakes hands. And you know when the referee brings the two boxers together, right? You know, it's to explain to them what the rules are and how to conduct themselves and et cetera. And they were predicting that his opponent would just knock him out in the first round. Well, he knocked him out. You couldn't believe, because guess what? The opponent was looking right at this pink. Okay? So he could hardly get his hands up to defend himself. And he was just like annihilated. And I mean, just the odds maker went, what happened? That was incredible. So, of course, next thing I got a phone call from the Dallas Cowboys. And they said, that's a football team. Not soccer, but football, for those of you who know what football in Europe is. And they call me up, and the coach says, hey, Alex, you know, would you like to come down to Dallas and show us how to use this? Because, you know, we're thinking of repainting the visiting locker rooms. So, and by the way, coaches around the country got that, and all of a sudden there were teams going into the women's, you know, locker rooms. They all painted pink now. So these teams got trashed pretty quickly. But the worst part of my life was about to begin. And this was when I went down to the, I think it was the 13th annual meeting of the ecology group that was studying the effects of allergy on health and behavior. And they had heard about my research in Pearson King County with the delinquents, and they said, well, have you presented your data anywhere? I said, no, not yet. And they said, well, we have a conference. We'd like to invite you down there, and would you, you know, talk? And it was like a three-day conference. About every 20, 30 minutes, a different presenter would talk about their research. Little did I know that the San Diego Union was in the back of the room that Saturday morning, and I talked about our findings. And what we found was excessive milk consumption among delinquents. That was the significant finding. It wasn't sugar. It wasn't anything else. It was just these kids drank an extraordinary amount of milk. And many of their parents described how these kids would get into fits of rage if there wasn't milk in the refrigerator. So they always made sure they stocked the refrigerator full of milk. And I remember, it was one of our co-investigators who called me at home and said, Alex, you're not going to believe it, because she was breaking down the data and breaking down the codes. And she said, these kids are drinking a lot of milk. And I said, oh, come on. You know, milk's a wholesome food. And they go, no, not for these kids. I mean, this may be the thing we've been looking at. I said, you can't go out in the world there and tell people that milk is causing delinquency or something. And she says, that's what the data shows. And I showed it to Dr. Simonson and to Dr. Bland and to other people. Everybody said, Alex, that's what it shows. So we went down there, and we were very cautious. We said, these are preliminary findings. These need to be replicated by other investigatory groups. But it's an interesting finding. Well, the San Diego Union puts it on the front page. Study hints too much milk may spark juvenile delinquency. But guess what the media starts to do with it? So here is an Associated Press release. Too much milk cited as cause of delinquency, right? This goes out all over the world, okay? And milk sales decline all over the world. The National Dairy Council writes this six-page letter, sends it to my university, urging that I be fired. The dean, however, Dr. Simonson, he stands up and tells the university he's the co-author and the data is sound, but preliminary, as was reported. And then, within a half a year, three states and Calgary, Alberta detention homes confirm these results. So the media disregard these confirmatory reports. But I had to deal with the National Dairy Council for years. They put me on their blacklist. Anywhere Alex Schau showed up, go after him. He's a danger to our industry, and you know, he's a crackpot, a quack, you know, not a scientist, and on. It never stopped. And here was the Seattle Times article, and this is what I really hated to see, that they would blame delinquency on milk, because all of us know it's far more complex than that. But you know, the media is a form of entertainment. And then you've never been anybody until you make the National Enquirer. I made the National Enquirer. So, you know, leading researchers, amazing finding. Heavy milk drinking may cause juvenile delinquency. And by the way, when Tom Ramirez called me, he never told me he was going to give that to the National Enquirer. So the story started to come out. Here's this guy talking about pink rooms, right? Talking about too much milk, talking about too much sugar. It was a bad combination in terms of creating credibility. But I want to let you know that I wasn't so much interested in the publicity at all. I just wanted to do the work in the field. And one of the things I really enjoyed at the time when I was probation chief was going over to McNeil Island Federal Penitentiary, which is in Washington State. It's an island surrounded by water. You can only get there by ferry. A lot of hardcore federal felons go there. And I started to work with the lifers. There's a group called SIG there. These are people who will spend the rest of their life in prison, and they're a real menace and they're a danger to the prison community because they have nothing to lose in terms of what they do. What are you going to do, put them in solitaire for another 30 days, so what? Well, anyway, I started teaching them about nutrition and diet and how it affects behavior. And eventually these inmates started petitioning the United States Bureau of Prisons to change the diet and allow them to have dietary supplements. And I want you to see the response from the federal government. This is you know, why even today you can see why I'm still frustrated, because this is still the position of the prison system in this country, probably in Canada as well. And what they're saying is, the food that we serve you is just fine. You don't need extra vitamins and minerals. Just eat your breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You'll get all the nutrients that you need. This was their conclusion. And they said, if you don't like that, you know, go ahead and appeal our decision, and good luck. And then actually the Dairy Association, the Sugar Association, all these people influenced the Bureau of Prisons to develop sort of a consensus standing position paper that would say that inmates don't need dietary supplements, they don't need dietary modification, there's no research support for this at all. It's all a lot of nonsense, and that still is the position of the federal government in terms of this. Well, eventually I finally wrote my first work on all of this. This was orthomolecular treatment of criminal offenders, and this I want to thank Dr. Michael Lesser, because without him urging me to write this, I guess I would have never put a lot of these initial experiences and studies into a monograph, and I want to thank him, and I thank him the rest of my life for doing that. He then knew Dr. Pauling, had asked Dr. Pauling to take a look at the book, and Dr. Pauling put his signature on the book and that wonderful quote about orthomolecular medicine on the cover, which, again, I thank Dr. Lesser for doing that. There was also studies done by others, and I want to make sure we give credit to a lot of people. There was Barbara Reed, of course, who I've mentioned, who has been a tremendous contribution. Had great conviction about the importance of nutrition in criminal offenders. Leonard Hipshin, who committed suicide, unfortunately, and by the way, he was a suicidologist at a university in Virginia, and he was under tremendous pressure by the Quackbusters. They really went after him hardcore, along with another professor who also espoused the view that nutrition could affect behavior at Western Michigan University, who also, I think Leonard was 51 years old when he committed suicide, and the other professor was 50 years old, and both of them had called me just the day before they committed suicide to tell me why they were so despondent, so depressed, because they could no longer take the pressure of all their critics attacking them, the faculty that was coming after them, the university administration, the assaults. It was just too much. And they ended their lives. And I curse those damn people, those quackbusters, for the damage they have caused so many wonderful people that I've met throughout my life whose passion and interest were to help others. But unfortunately, we're also attacking tremendous economic interests, and for that reason, they were under attack, not because what they said was not true. Certainly should also mention Sharaskin and Ringsdorf. I had the pleasure of actually touring in 1983 in Australia with Dr. Sharaskin. We did quite a wonderful lecture series together. Abram Hoffer has been an incredible inspiration to me and to many others in the orthomolecular field and nutritional medicine. And Michael Lesser, whose work in back in the 1970s and 80s in the orthomolecular meetings was a great inspiration to learning more and needing to know more about nutrition and behavior. Richard Koonin in San Francisco, a wonderful psychiatrist who always had that enormous energy and spirit to help us. There were so many people, and my apologies for anyone who I have forgotten. So then in 1978, and I'm going to start to end this, we began to offer a course called Body Chemistry and Offender Behavior. I gave over 100 of these courses to corrections officials in California. This I have a lifetime certification to teach in the university system in California. And so we taught them. They were all state-approved, all county-approved, and we got a chance to really sort of embed the idea in corrections people in California to use a lot of this. And besides going to California all the time, this was a 4 to 6 week schedule back in 1979. This was pretty typical in my life for the next 10 years. University of Puget Sound to teach a class there, Fairfax, Virginia, Juneau, Alaska, Boys Town, Nebraska, Kearney State University, Nebraska, Kansas City, Missouri, St. Paul, Minnesota, Toronto, Ontario. That was about 5 weeks of travel right there. And this was, I mean, I can't believe how many places I've been over the years trying to just get that word out to people that we can make a difference using nutrition and dietary supplements. But, you know, it started making a difference. Here, this is Red Bluff, California. Delinquents diet alters mood at juvenile hall. Fresno, California, diet study to curb delinquency. Getting crooks off junk food. This is in Los Angeles, where they actually set up a committee to change and radicalize the nutrition program for the entire county. Workshops that were offered were advertised all the time. Here's from one of the leading columnists of the Chicago Tribune, Too Much Sugar May Be Criminal. So we were getting the word out, and this was, oh my God, that's what I look like, huh, with my mustache. Delinquency blamed on bad food. This article appeared in newspapers throughout the country, and that led to my second book in 1980, Diet, Crime, and Delinquency. And I just continued, you know, I just wouldn't stop. And this, not only did I speak to groups, but I attended many scientific conferences. This was the 112th Congress of the American Correctional Association meeting held in Toronto. I had a huge audience there, but I would say 500 criminologists were there. And all I'm trying to do is say, look, let's do research. Do the studies. Don't tell me you disagree with me. Show me the data that I'm wrong. That's the key thing. If you disagree with me, that's fine. That's religion. But if you want to call yourself a scientist, show me the data that I'm wrong. This is the 5th National Conference on Child Abuse and Neglect, which was sponsored by the United States Department of Health and Education Welfare that was held at the University of Wisconsin. All these papers were published, by the way. There is the School Safety, which was jointly published by the U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Department of Education that went out to every single school district in the United States, 52,000 school districts. Here was a paper in the journal, International Journal of Neurology. The Twinkie defense, boy, that's another story. I could spend a whole hour on that. By the way, that's a total myth. There was no Twinkie defense in that trial in San Francisco at all. That was concocted by Time magazine. I can personally tell you that because I was the person that both the defense and the prosecution used as their expert witness in the Dan White case. And I dismissed the idea that nutrition had anything to do. That was sheer premeditated murder. There was no nutritional defense involved in that trial whatsoever. So that's a total myth. There is no Twinkie defense. And then there was the New York City public school system. After because of Dr. Lesser, you know, having me inspired enough to quickly sit down and write Orthomolecular Treatment of Criminal Offenders, the administration, the public school administration in New York City, read that work, called me up and said we'd want to change the diet in New York because we have a 36th percentile in national standardized academic test scores, and we need to do better. There were 17 students per teacher in that school system. They had the most educated teachers in the United States in terms of master's and doctorate degrees teaching children in school. And they had one of the worst school programs in terms of breakfast and lunch. And it was in 1978, a lead article in the cover of the New York Times that something had to be done about the school program. So we made changes there. And this is how Stephen Schoenthaler and I got to meet for the first time. I was looking for someone to work on the statistics on the school program. And he got involved in that program at my request. And this was at a time where Stephen did not believe that nutrition had an impact on criminal behavior. But from the experience he saw and what was going on in New York City, he became inspired enough in 1982 to start studies in Virginia. And later on, of course, as many of you know, he did studies in Texas, Alabama, and California, all of which supported findings that nutrition did affect antisocial behavior in a very positive way. I wrote a book in Japanese called Nutrition and Criminal Behavior, which was published by Brain Shupan. And this was because they were noticing in school systems throughout Japan that as they started to adopt our Western diet, the various types of fast food restaurants, convenience food, and moving away from their traditional foods, they would start seeing more and more antisocial behavior and discipline problems and conduct disorder and distractibility among students in the classroom. So Professor Osawa and I began to collaborate in 1984-85 to write this work, which has never been translated into English, by the way. And it was a very difficult work for me because it's in Japanese to work on because we had a talk about the Japanese diet, which I was not so familiar with, and he was a great inspiration in helping me prepare this book. And it got excellent reviews in the newspapers in Japan, by the way. And in 1994, I was invited to Tokyo to give a lecture on this subject. And the professors turned out from all over Japan to meet me and talk about this work and its importance. Simon Schuster, we published a lot of information about the New York City public school system study in 1991. This has been reprinted now in just a few months ago as a book called Feed My Brain. And it talks about how each one of these nutrients affects brain function. So it's a wonderful, useful book from that standpoint. And the question continues, does junk food promote crime? And in 1982, there was the first National Conference on Nutrition Behavior at the University of Texas at Austin. 990 academics showed up, and the U.S. Department of Justice, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And this was the first time that a national conference was held to look at this major question. Keynote at that conference, this kind of leads me into introducing or getting ready to have Stephen Carter introduce our next speaker, because this is Oxford. And I was very honored three times to be invited to lecture at Oxford, 1983, 1984, and actually live in Oxford in 1985 with my family and teach at the John Radcliffe Hospital Department of Pediatrics with Dr. Joseph Edgar. And this is where, for the first time, I met Bernard Gesch. And I have to say that I was so impressed that Dr. Gesch kept his word. And if I recall correct, and Dr. Gesch can correct me, I think this is High Street in Oxford, a very busy place where we do our shopping when we were there. Because he said that someday, Alex, I will take a look at this and I will do an actual study. And he kept his word. He actually kept his word. And I'm incredibly indebted to him for keeping his word and caring enough about the subject to get the funding, which I know was not easy, to establish the association, which I know took a lot of work, to get the government interested in the subject enough that a study can be conducted. And I'm really looking very forward to and eager to his lecture this morning. And if you missed any of what I said this morning, you fell asleep from jet lag or something like that, Barbara Griggs wrote a whole chapter which covers everything I've just discussed with you in The Food Factor. And the last thing I want to point out to you, this is the New York Times, April 30th, 2004. So here we are. Remember, I started in 1968. Now, this is sad. And this is why I'm frustrated. And that's the title of my presentation, because it states here that many counties in the United States today have over 30% of their population incarcerated. Just think of that. What a waste of life. What an expense. And if you don't think I'm frustrated, you weren't here at this lecture. Thank you very much.
That was a terrific presentation, Alex.